I don't know when Christmas starts for you, but think back with me, if you will, just a little bit. Around August, a strange thing happens in my family, in my life. I walk in from doing some yard work, and I'll think, this is strange. Kimberly is listening to jazz or instrumental, which she doesn't really ever do that at all. Or maybe Spotify has picked the wrong thing, because a Charlie Brown Christmas is playing, but it's 98 degrees outside. And then it gets a little bit more devious over the next couple of weeks. I'll come in and when Harry Met Sally is playing. And I'll think at first, this is just kind of a fall thing to do. Watch the movie, listen to the album. And then every single year, every season, like the first snow, it occurs to me what's happening. On this album, track 5 is Winter Wonderland. We're listening to Christmas music in August. Every single year this happens. And so if you thought to yourself, there's something off about Tyler, you're right. And now you know what that thing is. So I've learned how to combat this problem, how to fight back. And I want to start a little support group right here together. If you've had this problem, I've started a rule in my house. Nobody agrees with the rule, but it's law nonetheless. With no negative consequences, from the first time Christmas music is played until Thanksgiving Day, can insert potty words to any song and sidetrack the whole thing, right? When you have a 6-year-old boy, all you have to do is sing When Pootie Claus Comes to Town once, and he's laughing and starting so much mischief that there's no more Christmas songs being played. Or the best, The Grinch, you can do anything to that song. And it has this like climactic point, and you can change one word. I wouldn't touch you with a 39.5-foot poo. And that just like, that changes everything for this. And I could feel beady eyes from my 12-year-old daughter looking in the back of my head, just bringing down the heat for me. It starts really early, and it builds and it builds until Christmas Day arrives. And that's our whole culture, really. It starts way too early, and until D-Day, it just gets all that much more intense, doesn't it? And if you think about it, it's pretty astonishing what's happening. Celebrities and artists and musicians, they sing songs about a child who Mary delivered that will one day deliver her. And it blows my mind. Can you really sing those words? Like, these are the words of God. They're powerful and they're effective words. And random secular people are singing these words. Like, the consequences are huge. And then stores everywhere throughout our country put out symbols and signs of the incarnated God as an infant with people surrounding the incarnated one worshiping. And we just pass by it, but it still has some effect. You see that, and strangely, it pulls you in. And then there are parades and there are flotillas. That's a thing, a flotilla. And there are movies and television shows. And can you imagine if you took out Advent from our economy as a country? If you took out Black Friday or Cyber Monday week month, that thing, if you took that out, what would it be like? It's this thing in our culture. It's preparing us for something. It's pointing to an arrival. It's pointing to an awakening. And that's really what the core of Advent is all about. I don't even think it's a bad thing. I'm not suggesting that this is evil or we should stop doing these things. I'm not saying that we're longing for Jesus in this process, but it has, the way that we do Christmas now, developed this pull in our lives that make us wait for something, that make us look for something in the distance that hasn't yet come to be. It's why December gets so hectic for you. This is the reason why. In December, because something important is happening, because we've so wired this thing to make us want and long, we say to ourselves, we got to get together. That's what every group that you're involved in does in the month of December. Hey, we got to get together. If you can play an instrument, come play, even if it's terrible. There's something happening that we should get together and talk about. It happens in your neighborhood. It happens in your church. It happens in your chess club. Even your Dungeons and Dragons group gets together and does it. It's strange, but we got to get together. And then we start to think when we get together, we should probably like give something. We should have a gift ready. How else will they know they're really important? And so you go out and you spend way too much money, more than you ever meant to spend, and you have these gifts ready and you start to give these gifts to show that something is happening. And all too often, the church and pastors, we say this is superficial. And we denounce it as something that's bad, but maybe it's not bad. Maybe God is using this, because Advent means awaiting for something, especially something that's momentous, that's large. Now, Advent says we should look out for something. And as we look out, don't do it alone. We should get together as we look out. A giving is about to happen. And it's not a giving that you can go out and buy something to give it. And it's not a giving that you can, like, find or develop or strategize about. A giving is about to happen, and it's coming from God, and God is about to give us something. And he says what it is in Isaiah, back in the Old Testament, chapter 9, verse 2. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to use these verses as our format. Look at what it says. Isaiah 9, 2. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. Okay, so this giving is a great light. And the significance of this giving is the single message of the Old Testament. It's God taking 1,500 years to write out his story. So if you think July to December is a long time to think through Christmas, this is a 1,500-year Advent season for the people of God. And God is preparing something in the midst of this. He's not preparing the gift. The gift has always existed. What he's doing is preparing the people for the gift. So God's going around in every way that he possibly can, as a nation, as individuals, in good times and bad times, in the midst of darkness, in the midst of semi-light. And he's telling the people, it's not always going to be like this. There's not always going to be suffering and hatred. There's not always going to be foreign nations coming in to conquer you and eradicate you. It's not going to be this way. And the people of God are saying, well, do it. Stop talking about it and actually do this. What do you think the people really are thinking? They hate it. They hate the process. If you can remember back to when you were 6 years old, 7, 8 years old, you kind of hated the month of December. It was your least favorite month of the year. But December the 25th, that was glory day. You wanted that day to come and stay perpetually for the rest of your life. You wanted December to be over quickly, and you wanted the 25th to arrive. And that's what the people of God are begging in the Old Testament. Let this be over so the thing that you promise is coming can actually arrive. But God makes this process just drag on. Why does he do that? The preparation is awakening you to the grandeur of the gift. The preparation brings a depth into your heart and your mind and your soul that cannot be found anywhere else. I'd go this far. Now, more suffering happens in your life because of a lack of depth, then because of the thing that's actually causing the suffering. And if we would let God walk us through some processes like Advent, where you can only wait and you can only long, depth would begin to root itself down into your life, and you could suffer, but be deep enough to suffer with God. But because we never long or want or look or pray or beg, that depth isn't there. And when that depth is there, it just intensifies suffering all that much more. Think about your life. When you suffer, what's the primary thing that you want to happen? You want it to go away. You don't want there to be any more pain. You don't want there to be any more hurting, because our highest good as people is that no one would suffer. But God's highest good for us is not that no one would suffer. God's highest good is that we would see Jesus. If we actually believe the words of Jesus, that soon suffering will be no more, and there'll be no more pain, and there'll be no more weeping, and there'll be no more tears, we would reorient the way that we understand the here now. We're going to be in a day that there is no more suffering, and so until that day, I can wait for the arrival of the thing that's going to stop the suffering. And when suffering is happening now, what that suffering does is woke me up so that I can see the greatness of the thing that's coming and deepen me and prepare in my heart for this thing that's going to arrive. When you've been offended by somebody, when you've had your feelings hurt, when somebody's let you down, what's the primary thing you want to happen? You want to be seen. You want somebody to come and apologize. You want reconciliation to happen, which usually means you need to do these 7 or 8 things so that I can return to this friendship, this organization, this church, this family. Because your highest good, our highest good, is to be seen. It's to be accepted. It's to belong somewhere. When Jesus' highest acceptance for you is not that you'd be accepted by people around you necessarily, but you would finally understand that you're utterly and entirely accepted by him. And sometimes that takes a process of being hurt, of not belonging in the midst of different places, so that it can awaken you to the realization that there's a greater acceptance waiting for you. It's the acceptance by Jesus for you. And when that acceptance happens, it's just beautiful. You become agents of acceptance then, and because you've been made deep, you can enter into friendships, deep spiritual friendships. And when they reject you, you can be the one that goes and accepts them. Right? And so what I want us to see over Advent is that when the light comes and shines on us, it makes us aware of our own darkness. That's what was happening in Isaiah. If you'll study Isaiah some this week and go back to Isaiah chapter 1, watch how God makes them aware of their own darkness. This is Isaiah 1, 5 through 7. To see the light, you have to know darkness. And so God says to his people, "Why do you continue to rebel? Your whole head is sick and your whole heart faint. From the sole of your foot, even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They are not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. Your country lies desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. In your presence, foreigners devour your land. It is desolate, as overthrown by foreigners." When we read stuff like that in the Old Testament, we get mad. Why would God do that? Why not just overlook things and why not just pull people back and why not just forgive? And so we kind of get self-righteous and we think, how dare God do that? When in reality, in the Old Testament, God is constantly calling his people back to life and calling them back to health and calling them back to himself. Right? It's a lot like this when you read the Old Testament and get mad at God. It's like looking back at pictures of you when you were a little kid and then getting mad at your parents for letting you dress like that. I can't tell you how many times your parents told you, you don't want to wear that. You're going to hate one day that you wore that. Don't do your bangs like that. Nobody can see when you walk into a room. Don't dress like that. And you just were like, I'm dressing this way. I'm going to do this. And you see these pictures 12 years later. You're 24 years old and you're about to get married. And you're like, oh, burn these. That's the only thing you can come up with. And you're mad at your mom. And your mom's like, no, I told you over and over and over. And also, we're showing that at your wedding. It's just payback. It just works that way. It's like getting mad at your dad when you're 28. Why'd you let me live like that when I was 18? Why'd you let me do that when I was 24? You kind of let me burn my life down. You let me be irresponsible. You let me go into debt. You let me just have addictions. And your dad's saying, child, for a decade I prayed for you. I waited up for you every night. I chased you. I called you. I texted you. I pursued you. When you offended me, I forgave you. When you rejected me, I pursued you. I called you back over and over and over. And so in the Old Testament, God is constantly calling his people back, but he's not forcing them. Because you can't force love. And you can't force intimacy. You can't force relationship. If you force relationship and intimacy, that's slavery. And so God's not forcing you into slavery. He knows that in the process of longing and waiting, you're going to get hurt. And you're going to suffer. And he doesn't stop the pain. It's not God being mean to you. It's not. It's God realizing that the highest good in your life is not that you would never suffer, not that you would never feel pain. The highest good for you in your life is that you would give up on the shallowness and see the depth of waiting for the arrival of something large enough to change you and to make you right and good. That's what he's doing. Right? Because the rebellion of the Israelites is exactly like the rebellion of our own lives. We're in that same place of rebellion. It's dark and things are broken. And it's not because other people have done things to us. They might have. You might have been abused just horribly. But there comes this time in your life where you have to realize that you're not a victim, but you're the one with power and you're the one with opportunity. And if you're constantly giving that opportunity and power to somebody else, they hurt me, they offended me, they abused me, then there's no chance of healing in your life. What you have to do is realize that the rebellion that's happening is me. I'm the primary rebellious one. And when I take that understanding, it's then I can go to Jesus and say, I'm the rebellious one. I'm the broken one. Heal me. And so God uses the process and he uses your longing to teach you about darkness, your darkness, so that the light can shine in on your darkness. And when you see your darkness, you finally find yourself in a place that maybe you're unaccustomed to being in. You're very smart people. You're highly educated. You have a lot of gifts and talents. You have relative wealth, especially in terms of worldwide finances. And so what happens to you and to me is when problems and issues arise, you can throw some force at it. You can put some money towards it. You can use your gifts and your abilities to overcome those things. And yet, every now and then, very seldom though, because of who you are, you find yourself in a place where you realize, I can't fix this. The Israelites in Isaiah chapter 1 are in a place where they haven't yet realized that they can't fix it yet. They know they've broken something with God, and so their solution is, hey, we'll throw a little bit more religion at this, we'll try to do some more sacrificing, and that'll make things right with God. God will be pleased with us. And so they're doing all of this religious rites and ceremonial stuff, and look what God has to say to it. It seems mean, but it's actually the most gracious thing that God could do. This is Isaiah 11:1-11-15. What to me is the multitude of your sacrifices, says the Lord? I've had enough of burnt offerings and of rams and the fat of well-fed beasts. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. Bring no more vain offerings, incense and admiration to me. New moon and Sabbath, that is calling of convocations. I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. For once, because the darkness is finally understood by you, you realize you can't fix this. No amount of religion in your life can fix the darkness that's in your soul. So much so that God looks at my religion and your religion and he says, I hate your religion. And here's why God hates your religion. Religion is putting a nice sacramental robe over a body that's been beaten, cut, and is infected with all kinds of brokenness. And so you look down at yourself and you think, I look pretty good because you have a nice robe on. But on the inside, you're festering and dying. And God looks at you and he says, I hate your pretty robe because you're dying on the inside. And I don't want you to die on the inside anymore. Right? No amount of good deeds can make up for what you've done, what I've done. I even say this. I think some of you should just start a terrible cussing problem. You thought too long that not cussing and not drinking and not smoking makes you right with God. And so just let all that junk in your life out. Just start blowing it out. Maybe that would be the gateway to open up that your good deeds aren't really all that good. Maybe you should let some of your racism out. It's in there. Like the self-righteousness that you're not racist is silly. Just let it out some so that maybe you could be overwhelmed by how dark you really are. Maybe some of your anger issues should finally just come out. I'm not saying like beat somebody or yell at somebody, but maybe go into a room, close the door, and just let it out so you can really finally understand how angry you are. No good deed is going to undo those things. All you can do in this moment is wait. And I can't explain to you. You can't even comprehend the depth that's there. when all you can do is long and when all you can do is look for something that's greater than yourself to arrive, it prepares you, and it's the only thing that prepares you for the arrival of the thing that's great enough to do something in your life. Do you see the importance of Advent? Do you see why you need to slow down? Do you see why you need to long and wait and realize the darkness and that you can't fix it? Because if you finally will do that, it doesn't bring you to a place where you're hopeless. It brings you to a place that you have great hope. Because you start to look for something that's on the horizon that's coming that God has promised. And here's the thing that God has promised. This is Isaiah 7:14, right before chapter 9. Building up to this, he says, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name is called Emmanuel." The purpose of the Old Testament, the purpose of Advent, is to teach me and to teach you that the only hope of all of humanity is bound up in one man. That one man's name is Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. God came and was with us. Not just walking around in godly stature. He walked around as a human being. You've heard that all of your life, even if you're not a follower of Christ, even if you've never been in church. But God became a human being. That's bizarre in every other place of the world and every other point of history, that God would become one of us. This man who our hope is bound up is God. And he didn't just become us in a generic way. He became, according to the scriptures, you. Jesus became you. Jesus became your darkness so that his light could shine on your darkness and scatter it. That's Christianity. Jesus became your "I can't fix this." And he countered your "I can't fix this" with, "Oh, but I can. I can fix this." This is the Godhead. This is who has come to be with us. And so our hope over Advent is to demonstrate to you that Jesus is the incarnation of light, that Jesus is the incarnation of joy, the incarnation of justice. What I mean is, Jesus didn't come to teach us about justice. Jesus is justice. Jesus didn't come to bring joy to us. Jesus is joy. And so we'll do that every week. And with the last few minutes that I have in this conversation this morning, I want to show you how Jesus is the incarnation of light. And so that takes place in the New Testament when Jesus is walking around with us in flesh and blood. One of the best places that you can see Jesus being the incarnation of light is in Mark chapter 2, verses 13 through 17. If you have a Bible, look there with me. Here's what it says. This is Jesus being the incarnation of light. "He went out again beside the sea, and all the crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, 'Follow me.' And he rose and followed him. And as he reclined at the table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, 'Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?' And when Jesus heard it, he said to them, 'Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call righteous, but sinners.'" So how is this a passage about Jesus being the incarnation of light? Well, how do you show light? You go into the darkest place and you turn the light on, and then those in the darkness can, without any doubt, see that the light is there. Levi, who is also known as Matthew, is the darkest man, according to the people of the first century. It's not a rapist, it's not a murderer. Levi encapsulated that which was absolutely the darkest. He was a traitor. He looked to the enemy and he said, "I would rather have what you have than be with my people. I don't care about flesh and blood. I don't care about relationship. I don't care about love. I just want what you have." And so he left love and relationship and he went to get what they had. And then he used what the Romans had to steal from his own people. And so he was using his own people as a leveraging point to live large. Right? So if you watch your next door neighbor buy really nice cars and improve their house and go on wild vacations and spend lavishly, and they were spending your money lavishly, what do you think you would say about that person? Oh, you'd hate him. You would hate him deeply. That's my vacation. That's my car. That's my kids' education. That's my retirement. That's my money. That traitor is serving ISIS and getting wealthy off of my stuff. He was a tax collector. Listen to some of the taxes that he would collect. Because when something is every single day, every single action, you hate them all that much more. There was a ground tax. So if you grew anything at all, whatever you grew, they got 10% of. Levi took 10% of everything you grew. There was income tax. There was duty tax. So if you brought anything from another country or took anything to another country, and Rome at the time was all these tiny little organizations of countries. So everywhere you went, you were getting taxed. There was travel tax to go on main roads, side roads, back roads, or bridges. There was pack animal tax. So if you wanted to take anything anywhere, they taxed your horse. There was wheel and axle tax. So they got your horse and they got your wagon as well. And then there was purchase tax. So not only are they taking money from your income, but whenever you buy something, they tax. So every single time you turned around, Levi was there saying, "Give me your money." He was a trader living large off of your life. He was hated. Levi's the darkest man there was. And Jesus looks at Levi and he says, "I want the darkest man." That's Christianity. Jesus didn't come for the righteous. Jesus didn't come for the religious. He didn't come for the pretty or the educated or the wealthy. He came for traitors. He came for those who commit treason. He came for those who sell out. He came for cowards. He came for those who will steal from the poor and live large off what they stole from the poor. That's Christianity. That's amazing. That's different than everything else. And so if you find yourself in the darkest place today, if you think you're the darkest woman, if you think you're the darkest man, he came for you. And if you're not the darkest man or the darkest woman, then how much more able is he to come for you as well? He came for you. Do you see what the darkness does in Levi's life? Consider the darkness. Consider the effects of the darkness. In Levi's life, he lived in public, but he was hidden. Nobody saw him. Nobody knew him at all. Can you imagine a life like that? The passage says that the tax booth was on a road, and thousands of people were following Jesus. And so these people are going before Jesus, and they see Levi, and they're pointing at Levi, and the first one says, "I hate that guy." And then it begins to feed and grow. And the second person, and the 400th person, and the 3,000th person, the anger just grows all that much more. They're pointing at Levi, and they don't really know Levi, but they hate Levi. And so they just have built this vilification against Levi in a way that he's seen by everybody, but he's hidden. Nobody really knows him. And we live in darkness like that. It breeds fear. Darkness breeds fear. Matthew Levi is thinking to himself, if they hate me this much and they don't know me, when they find out who I really am, how much more are they going to hate me? That's what darkness does to me and darkness does to you as well. When we hide sin, when we hide our brokenness, it breeds fear. I'm going to get found out. Everybody gets found out sooner or later. So you dream about it and you wake up anxious and you worry all day about the things that you're hiding in the darkness. And you try to pretend that nobody sees it when almost everybody sees it. And you know that ruin is coming your way because when you get found out, everybody will betray you. They hated you before, and now how much more do they hate you? And so what does Jesus do? What does he do? He outs Levi in public. It's no longer in the darkness where it can breed fear. Now it's been brought out into the light. It's the megaphone of Jesus where Jesus is saying definitively, "Watch me. Watch me. what I'm about to do is shine the light into the darkest man and make the message clear. When you bring things into the light, those things are seen and forgiven. And so all you need do is bring it into the light. You need to be brought into the light. That's the message of Advent. The light has come, the light's name is Jesus, and you should be brought into the light. When you're brought into the light, everything that was hidden and causing fear is revealed and forgiven. Bring it into the light and you will be forgiven. And then finally, and here's where we'll end our time today. When Matthew is in the darkness, he's aimless. It's a very aimless life. He doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't know what he's trying to accomplish. He can't see anything because the darkness is so dark. So he's just tripping around and meandering through his life. The best thing that Levi can come up with is this: I'm going to get a lot of money and I'm going to have a lot of stuff. And the stuff and the money is going to numb the fact that I'm a traitor. It's going to numb the fact that I'm dead. It's going to numb the fact that I don't have any understanding of who God is. And so all I can really think about doing with my life is making money. And so he has money and he has stuff, but he doesn't have any passion. And he doesn't have anybody who loves him, and he doesn't have any friendships, and he doesn't have any concept of that he should change the world that he lives in. All he can think about is, give me money. And then the light comes, the incarnated light of God, Jesus. And Jesus looks right at Levi and says, follow me. Follow me. It's not a one-time prayer. It's not pray this prayer and be a Christian. It's follow me. It's not a one-time experiential thing at a camp. Ah, I saw Jesus at camp. I'm a Christian. No. It's drop everything and follow me. It's a lifetime lifestyle change. It's your whole life following God. Follow me. And when you follow Jesus, it gives you purpose. You're not aimless anymore. You're not tripping around in the darkness. The light is come and the light has seen you, and you have a new purpose in your life. Your only purpose in this life is to follow Jesus. That's why we get up front in Advent and in Advent ask you to give financially. Isn't that bait and switch? Why would we do that? Let's just talk about baby Jesus and not talk about money at all. Here's why we ask you to give. Because Jesus doesn't need your money. He doesn't need a single penny that you have. You giving is about you following. And what you need any more than anything else is to be in a place where your whole life is changed by your following. And that always starts with your money. When you reorient your finances so that Jesus is primary in your life, you're following him with your safety net. And when you follow him with your safety net, he becomes your safety net. So we ask you to give so that you can actually follow Jesus. We ask you over this month, why don't you love somebody that's especially hard to love? And don't let it just be December, but what if you start in December and then it captivates your heart? Why would you love somebody that's impossible to love? Because you were impossible to love, and Jesus said, follow me. He loved you first, and so now, as you love others like Jesus loved you, you're following him with your life, and you're no longer aimless in the darkness. We ask you in this season and really all year long, hey, why don't you start to live in faith? Why don't you actually believe Jesus can change your workplace and act like a follower of Jesus there? Why don't you actually believe Jesus can change your neighborhood and love people because Jesus loved them? Why don't you do something that would use your one and only life to change the city that you live in? And in that moment, you're following Jesus and Jesus shows up. It's the process. It's the longing. It's the waiting. And when you wait and long, Jesus arrives and he shines the light and all has been forgiven. And now your life has purpose. And so we call you to a place over the next 4 weeks to consider the one who has been promised. And all you can do is wait, and it builds hope, and your hope is in him. And when you get Jesus, you have the very thing that you were created for. Let's pray. God, we ask that in this moment we would we would see the light incarnated. That's our prayer, Lord. Help us wait. Help us yearn. Help us long. Let us see our own darkness. Let us see that we can't fix this. But more than anything else, let us see the light. That Jesus is the light. He is the light of life. And the light has shone in the darkness, and the darkness will not overcome it. These are the words of John. These are the words of life. These are the words of Jesus. Use these words to change us. We love you, and we ask these things in your name, Jesus. Amen.